That's my sweet, ooh, informed, therapeutic, not narcissist or addicted confidant. Or maybe you are and you're here to learn. I don't know. Welcome to another episode of Confidently Insecure, the podcast where we are absolutely sure we don't know everything. I am your host, Kelsey Darrah, and I am so, ooh, this is going to be a good one, y'all. This is going to be a good one. I need you to turn up your volume. I need to open up your ears. I need you to be in a space where you can look at the tough stuff, maybe dive into your own traumatic past, but we're going to be here. It's a safe space, and we've got our wonderful guide and expert with us to get through it. We have this week Bryn Sisipio, a very fun Italian last name to say, who is a licensed marriage, couples, and addiction therapist from Pennsylvania, who is the owner of BCA Therapy with over 10 years of clinical experience working with long-term consequences of unhealthy and addicted relationships. Bryn, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you today.
I just first have to know, like, we've had so many therapists and doctors and psychologists on this podcast. I have to know what got you into the specialty of sort of addictive relationships with narcissistic abuse. What gave you insight into wanting to go deeper into that category?
Well, if we bring it all the way back, I actually was a parole officer for many years.
Wow.
And within that realm, to make a very long story short, I came across a lot of individuals, as you can imagine, who were coming through the criminal justice system, coming through jails and through the courts, that had problematic use with drugs and alcohol. So there was little support, little treatment. I mean, people were doing the best they can with what they had, but the resources were not enough. So I made the decision to go back to school and to get my degree and then to start working as a therapist. And to be honest with you, so many people, individuals, couples, families that I see where addiction is a part of their unfortunate life and their family history, there also tends to be a presence of really toxic relationships as well. And I see a lot of people that then turn to drugs, alcohol, or other unhealthy relationships as a way to kind of like avoid and not deal with or escape from the toxicity that has been present in their lives.
Wow. I find that so incredible that you saw something in the system that felt wrong or like a chink in the armor, and you were like, I see where the equation ain't mathin', and I'm gonna go back to school to try and help reverse this. And that's so interesting to me, being a parole officer. I imagine, did you work more with women or men in your field?
There tends to be more men in the criminal justice system than women, just as, you know, a general population, you know, if we're looking at that. The parole department's divided up into a couple different specialties and areas and sections. The group that I had that I was assigned to were people who were just constantly violating the conditions of their parole. So I wasn't able to work closely with people on the rehab side of things. What my job was to bring them back in front of their judge and saying, hey, this person's not following the rules, whether it's they got a new arrest or they kept using drugs. But I would see the same people. And that's where the problem was. Like, they were leaving me, someone else was working with them or trying to or not, and then they would come back in.
Maybe you were just such a good parole officer, they were trying to hang out with you more.
Yeah. I don't think too many of them wanted to hang out with
Maybe me not. Either. That's the optimist in me being like, yeah, you're just so great. I am so curious on your thoughts of the way we treat addiction in the punitive system in terms of how do we, and especially you're seeing people after they're out of the system, are we setting them up for success, or are we acknowledging it as, you know, a disease, which I have like convoluted thoughts on? Like, what's your opinion?
Things are definitely progressing in a positive direction in terms of how the criminal justice system is responding to substance use disorder, responding to mental health. Is it enough? No. Will it ever be enough? Probably not, because by the time someone finds themselves in the criminal justice system, the criminal justice system is dealing with a set of behaviors that a person's displaying, when really what we have in front of us is a person with a history of trauma, a person with a history of oppression, a person with a history of family legacies that go back beyond, 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 beyond. So the criminal justice system shouldn't really be fully engaged in treating what happens three generations before in your family. Right. Now, that being said, there are a lot of specialty courts that are on the scene that have been popping up. Like, you have a behavioral health court that really supports people that once they find themselves in the criminal justice system, they're getting a lot of treatment for their mental health, a lot of medication support, medication management. Around me, there is a veterans court. So any veteran, which, you know, PTSD sometimes can really lead to very challenging behaviors that may find you in the criminal justice system. There's a veterans court program. We also have what's called the drug court program. And there's actually the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. That started like in 1989, I believe it was. And I think now to date, there's probably close to 4,000 drug court local programs. So things are getting a lot better. There's a lot of different areas of the criminal justice system where training certainly could be improved. Sure. I would say it's a lot better than it once was, and we can still grow.
Do we just like not have enough therapists, like in general, do you think? Or is it really the training? Because like you came at it from a very, I have to assume whether you liked it or not, became a very like in trauma informed therapist and a very like addiction specialist therapist. And then you became the therapist. Do you think it's like, are we working top down or bottom up? And do we have enough?
Yeah. So again, like same thing with the criminal justice. Well, could everyone go to therapy? Sure. Yeah. Should everyone probably go to therapy? Yeah. Is there a therapist for everybody? Like, I don't know.
Right.
You know, it would be nice if there was.
Right.
And going to therapy, you know, you can attempt to address something when you're 20 and it may look very different when you're 35. Family dynamic stuff when you're single may look different when you're married. Child versus childless, like all of those dynamics can influence how you respond to therapy, personality of your therapist, different things like that. So there's a lot of influence in terms of like what makes a good match and what can be supportive of people.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's enough therapists in the world. I definitely think that the training that therapists receive can range. And sometimes that's really, really good training and really, really good supervision and amazing education. And sometimes it's not hitting that mark.
Yeah. And I have to imagine when you're talking about or, you know, seeing clients the way you do, where there's kind of like this specialty niche in it, that you had to have a certain amount of training to understand like the cycle of addiction and trauma and generational trauma and like what a narcissist is. Like, do you feel like you gravitated towards that because of your experience as a parole officer?
Definitely with the addiction piece, with the drug and alcohol piece, for sure. That was something that was really driving. It was really driven by my, like, something else has to happen here, right? Like, when we incarcerate someone that is using drugs or alcohol, there is a benefit there in terms of it stops the behavior, right? So when we know this person's becoming incarcerated, they're not going to overdose. They're not going to kill someone in a DUI car crash or anything like that. So we're stopping the behavior, but we're not treating the behavior. So my focus was, okay, I can stop the behavior all day long, right? Got that. But how are we treating the behavior and making sure it doesn't keep happening? And then through that, you know, your work kind of evolves as a therapist and what you really want to get into and clients you really feel connected to and things that you really seem to understand and frameworks that you apply. So there's a certain amount of like professional development that I guess happens concurrently with your experience as well.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense too. Like, you probably learn a lot from the different types of cases that come in and, you know, have to reroute with what you learn and bring to the table. I want to talk about even just say someone isn't coming from the criminal justice system. Do you see regular old folks that civilians, if you will, with this same kind of stuff? Or do you still mostly work with formerly incarcerated?
No. So right now in my private practice, it's non-criminal justice system clients.
Got it.
We do have some clients that will get find themselves in a little bit of hot water. DUI is kind of the most common thing, but it's mostly just regular people. I don't even want to say regular people.
I know, right? It's like
people,
what's the,
yeah, it's like stigmatizing in and of itself. Yeah. But people who have not been arrested, right. People who are coming here of their own free will, they're not court mandated, and their challenges and their struggles are just as big as those who have been court mandated and who have been arrested and who have been in the criminal justice system.
So I have been sober from alcohol for 2.5 years, and I was very lucky to never have experienced DUI or arrest because of that. And I truly thank the universe every single day, like can't, you know, thank my lucky stars. And I think that it's not talked about enough about what, like how addiction develops and like how that informs your relationships. And so I'd love to dive into that a little bit. And I wonder, like, first of all, what are your thoughts of what addiction is? Is it a disease?
Yeah, so I definitely subscribe to that belief that it is a disease. And I like to, for people who say cancer is a disease and kids who have cancer didn't choose this, they didn't put the cancer in their body, you put the drug in your body, you put the alcohol in your body. What the metaphor that I like to use is diabetes. So diabetes can certainly have a genetic predisposition. It can be something that we don't choose, right? And depending on how we understand it, what we know about it in our family history, and then how we live our lives can increase the chance that we become an insulin-dependent diabetic who's getting their limbs amputated or not. So same thing with addiction, right? If I am diabetic, so diabetes actually does run in my family, and my A1C is probably a little bit higher than it should be. And it doesn't help that I have cases of Girl Scout cookies in my house.
Oh, girl, I've been able to avoid it this season somehow.
Well, I got a sugar addiction. My house. So, it's rough.
Well, yeah, you got it. You're eating from your own supply. You're getting high on your own supply.
Exactly. So there's things that if you have a genetic predisposition to diabetes, you should make sure you're not smoking, make sure you're not drinking, make sure you're not eating an incredible amount of carbohydrates and sugars, move your body, don't live a sedentary lifestyle, right? Well, if in your family history, there seems to be a genetic predisposition or a pattern of unhealthy use. So no one has to say, well, my grandmother never went to an AA meeting, so therefore she's not an alcoholic. If it doesn't look okay, if something in your stomach says, I don't know why every gathering we have to do this, or I don't know why so-and-so doesn't seem to be able to hold their liquor, then you need to think to yourself, what's the intentional relationship I want to have with alcohol, if any, right?
Yep.
How do I want this to look in my life? What do I want this to be? There is a concept in the field of addiction when we're talking about this genetic predisposition that says when you first start using, let's say you first start drinking 13, 14, 15 years old, okay, that is heavily influenced by your environment, right? All your friends are doing it, peer pressure, bullying, whatever the case may be. As you get older, the environmental influence decreases, and that's where if there is a genetic predisposition, if there is a disease, that will increase. So that will take over. Prime example, college campuses. You can go to any college campus today in this very moment, swipe 30 kids off campus, survey them about their alcohol use, and a large percentage would meet the diagnostic criteria for inpatient treatment.
Wow. Calling them out. I agree. It's a problem.
Now, take those 30 kids. They graduate. They get jobs. A lot of them are no longer meeting the criteria for inpatient treatment. Why? because there's not a disease there. Mm. The genetic predisposition isn't there. Mm. The environment changed. Mm-hmm.
And their management of it changed. Whereas,
exactly,
like someone like exactly. me, I continued to have a bottle of wine every night because I was like, I deserve this. Or like, because I'm a wine girl. Or like, I'm just at home watching Game of Thrones and I need a bottle of wine because they're drinking wine. It's like, if you can separate that and have that healthy relationship with alcohol, we're not, like you said, we're not carrying that disease, but it right, really is. Right. I was going to ask you, like, where do you see, what age do you see the most influence on that long-term disease staying versus breaking off? And I assume, is it kind of college age, 20s?
Yeah, it definitely can be college age. But I'll tell you what, the pandemic was very interesting because there was a lot of people in their 30s and 40s that were saying, this was never a problem for me until, thank you, COVID, and now I can't stop, right? And so what we were seeing there is, again, a change in the environment. So now we had people where these natural deterrents were dropping off. Mm. So it wasn't, I have to go to work in the morning and I have to drive in,
right,
or I have to go give a presentation in front of my boss. It was, oh, I can roll downstairs, hungover, in my pajama pants, turn on my computer. No one needs to even see my face today. And so therefore these deterrents, they don't really mean anything. So it wasn't that people were saying, oh, I can't drink because I have to go to work tomorrow. When the pandemic hit, it was, oh, actually, I can have a drink because I don't got to do anything but click on a couple emails.
Right, right.
So again, COVID changed things in terms of like the age and what we were seeing there. I equate it more to like the natural deterrents were no longer at play. Mm-hmm. And the world was like kind of on fire, going to hell in a handbasket. No, it was like 2 weeks, 2 weeks, 2 weeks. And here we are like 2 years later.
Yep.
Nobody knew what was going on. So the stress, I think there was a part of excitement about that. Oh, we're home. Like, order your kids 8 million things off Amazon and keep them busy, you know? It seemed like a little mini vacation at first. So the pandemic certainly changed a lot of things. But generally speaking, outside of that, you can see a shift for people who go to, and again, doesn't apply to everybody, traditional 4-year college, that behavior looks like one way. And then when they graduate, it may or may not change. And again, that can be maybe one indicator.
Yeah, sure. I wonder, how does being an addict or alcoholic or having an unhealthy relationship with those substances inform our relationships? Because I feel like we think about the obvious of it's a way to escape, or it's a thing that masks you, where you're allowed to be more, I'm making air quotes, free in the way you speak to someone. It allows anger to come out more easily. Maybe people feel like they can use it as an excuse. But what are maybe some of the other ways that we're not thinking of how these addictions inform our relationships to ourselves and other people?
When you have someone that's in a relationship, and I'm just going to use a romantic relationship because we have relationships with everyone in our lives, right? When we're in a romantic relationship with someone, it really can permeate every aspect of our lives. Mm-hmm. So sex, right? Sex is an important part of a relationship. Yeah. And if you are drunk, it can really challenge your ability to perform or to enjoy the experience of having that like lovely intimate exchange with someone that you want to be connected to. Mm-hmm. So that can be one way. How you smell, which could change your intimacy as well. You know, if you're drinking a lot and you're sweating and then you kind of smelly during the day, your hygiene and how you take care of yourself may not always be up to par. Mm. You may also begin to really just decline in your physical health. Mm. And again, like, it can be scary for a lot of people to watch their partner physically decline in front of them, whether it's putting on an incredible amount of weight gain, their skin changing, how they breathe, You know, when you are, alcohol is a depressant, right? So it depresses your central nervous system, which means you're probably going to be snoring now when you're sleeping. It means that you're probably going to be reacting a little bit slower than you normally would. Your eyes may look a little bit different. So you don't necessarily have to be falling down drunk for it to create distance in your relationship. And when it gets to the point that alcohol is such a significant problem for you, any one of those little things can be a great distance maker.
Right. Exactly. Right.
So if you're snoring, if you have a funny look in your eye, if you didn't shower till late in the day, all of those things. And then once really distance enters the relationship, we're not communicating clearly and directly. We're not communicating with empathy. We're not engaging in compromise and doing nice things for one another. It's like we're keeping score. And it doesn't even have to be about keeping score that these are the nights that you drank and these are the nights that you don't drink. It could be, well, I did this for the house, or, you know, I've made dinner for four nights in a row, or I've picked your clothes up 17 times today, whatever it may be. Right. And then that just creates a hierarchy within the relationship.
Right.
And it, these are really hard places to come back from.
Yeah. And I want to know about what you think of addiction and narcissism going. Do they go hand in hand, and why?
So they can. One of the tricky things is that when you have experienced a substance use disorder, so whether you are addicted, physically dependent upon alcohol or drugs, the function of addiction is to take over its host and kind of like control the environment so that way the addiction can continue. So sometimes you may have someone that is really struggling with their alcohol and drug addiction, and they're engaging in behaviors that look like narcissism, right? That they are lying to people, they're manipulating, they are gaslighting people, they are really stealing, you know, trying to convince people that what's happening is not what they're seeing, and vice versa. So for someone who is in active addiction, it very much can mimic narcissistic behaviors, because that's the function of the disease. Like that's how the disease lives, right? Like addiction lives in extreme. Addiction lives in lies. It's not going to serve. That's like the oxygen that fuels it, you know?
Yeah. And is there an opposite to that in like, what about narcissists who become addicted or who are alcoholics? Does it like, I don't really know much about narcissism. I think I was in I've talked about it before on the podcast. I was in a emotionally and physically abusive relationship in my early 20s with someone who I 100% believe was a narcissist, like didn't live in the same plane that the rest of us did. And when he drank, it was certainly worse. It was like adding gasoline to the fire. But I don't know that his use was the cause of his narcissism. It was almost like, I was like fearful when that did happen, because I was like, oh God, you don't know what kind of Jekyll Hyde situation was going to come out.
Shout out to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast. My confidants, you guys know I have recently been going through just an absolute, just wild mental health re-uptick, refresh. And I would not have been able to do that without my counselor, who I love, at BetterHelp. What's interfering with your happiness? What's preventing you from achieving your goals? I personally knew I had this ketamine therapy journey starting soon, and I was so nervous, and I needed that person, that third party, that doctor who knew what they were talking about to help me get prepared for that environment, as well as reintegrate all of things I've learned back into my daily life. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling. And BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. And you can start communicating with them in under 24 hours. There are licensed professionals and counselors who are specialized in areas such as self-esteem. Ugh, who doesn't need it? Grief. Oh God, things are so hard. LGBT matters. So gay. Family conflict. Mom. And anger. And depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, and trauma. Anything you share is confidential. It's convenient, professional, and affordable. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they are recruiting counselors in all additional 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. And as a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting betterhelp.com/CI. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CI.
Confidant, sober girlies, are you looking to cut back or cut out alcohol this year? Come on, join me and Zach on our sober journeys. Recess Zero Proof craft mocktails are the perfect alcohol replacement. We've recreated the cocktails you know and love, like a lime margarita and a grapefruit paloma, so you can enjoy the flavors and feelings of those cocktails without the booze. That's right, zero proof, zero compromise. Listeners can get 15% off the Recess mocktail sampler at takearecess.com/Kelsey. Each can is lightly sparkling mocktail infused with functional ingredients like so many stress balancing adaptogens made with real fruit and only 25 calories or less. It's a guilt-free way to unwind. Whether you're relaxing after work or hanging out with friends, make Recess mocktails your drink between drinks or, like me, your forever mocktail. I am so obsessed with the ginger lime mule and also the grapefruit paloma for spring. It's my favorite go-to weekend drink. Get 15% off Recess mocktails now at takearecess.com/Kelsey so you can enjoy your favorite cocktails without the consequences.
Right, because it did magnify his behaviors, right?
Yeah.
So I would not say, and I'm just double checking myself as I'm thinking here, I would not say that addiction leads to narcissism. Mm. When we are talking about, and the technical term is like narcissistic personality disorder.
Right.
When we have individuals that have a personality disorder, mm-hmm. this is something that is not treatable. It is something that cannot be cured.
Mm.
Drug and alcohol, absolutely treatable.
Wow.
Absolutely can live a life in recovery. Absolutely can change your behaviors there.
Yeah.
But for someone who has a narcissistic personality disorder, that's not changing. So you may see someone, again, because of the function of their addiction, may look like they have some of this stuff going on. But if we see them in recovery, that'll drop off.
Mm.
Right. That's not going to be present anymore. I wouldn't say that there's a high population of individuals that have narcissism that also are addicted to drugs and
right.
alcohol, but it definitely can coexist.
Right. Because that's kind of what I'm thinking in my head is like the stuff you're talking about with the alcohol and addiction, once you get rid of that and how much better your life can be, like, that's me. I'm like, yeah, I'm the poster child for that. And
right, right.
The confidants hear me talk about it all the time, that I'll never try to convince you to get sober, but I will scream from the rooftops about how much better my life is and only hope that that would inspire other people.
Right.
But when I think about my ex, I'm like, that was who he was. And
yes,
I don't know that maybe getting out of that relationship fueled or played into my problems with alcohol. And I've talked about this before on the podcast. I have a hard time with the word alcoholic because I think in AA, of which I didn't do the program, I tried and I was like, this ain't for me. I feel like they perpetuate the idea that you're either an alcoholic or you're a completely normal functioning person, or
right,
your life
right,
is one right. drink away from falling apart, or you're completely sustainable with managing your alcohol usage. And I'm like, that's too much of a gray area for me. But I yeah. wonder, like, how that abusive relationship, I'd never thought about it until this very moment, might have informed some of my alcohol issues, like just not dealing with that trauma.
Yeah, your response to it. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the
fear of, like, who he turned into when he was drinking.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a lot of people who do have this type of personality disorder that don't drink because they want to remain in control.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because they want to be able to have that constant access mm-hmm. to the narcissistic supply.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I don't think it's as common. I've seen it. It certainly coexists. Mm-hmm. But like, it does not lead to,
right. And
you know, like,
he
this is who you
much.
Are.
Like
right.
you're spot on. Like he never really did drink. And when he did, it was like a beer or two, and I think then that opened the floodgates of like, a reason to be even more using that power and control dynamic.
Right. Right.
Do we have a predisposition to having an addictive personality?
So this is interesting because there's different theories on this, right? Like, is there such thing as an addictive personality? There's a really cool book. It's an old book by Craig Nochen about like addictive personality and what it looks like. My approach is this. So I don't, there's not a personality disorder when it comes to addiction. There is something for a lot of people that do have a drug and alcohol addiction that they are attracted to extremes. Mm. So I may see people that are sober and very high powered jobs and working 100 hours a week and right, exactly. And in the gym 12 hours a day, coaching 75 sports teams for their kids, things like that. So there is something about always living in the edges, always being in the extreme that gives them a rush, a sense of purpose, a drive that feels very comfortable for them. Mm-hmm. So when I'm working with people and we're talking about recovery, the word I use is balance. Mm. You may do things that are healthy, again, air quotes, healthy, but anything in extreme is not healthy. Even when you look at the research that people have done on clean eating, sometimes that's still not healthy and safe for you if you get too extreme with it. Mm-hmm. If you're working out to the extreme, you can actually increase your ability to get injured. Mm-hmm. You're not letting your body recover. If you're working 700 hours a week, which doesn't exist, but if you work, you know, 162 of the 168 hours that are in a week, not healthy, not balanced, incredibly stressful. Yeah. So I don't know if there's an addictive personality, but I definitely think that people who experience addiction enjoy the extremes.
Yeah. And you're like hitting the nail on the head. I'm just thinking of my close circle of friends and family that are addicts that got sober and became like obsessed with CrossFit or like obsessed with doing their work or whatever. Or like if we go to DIY something, it's like the biggest version. It's like the most, that's probably my problem is my boyfriend will tell you that I have an unrelenting determination and willpower. Like I will not give up on something. Like if you tell me this round hole won't fit in that square peg, I will fucking make it. Like I will not walk away until it fits in. And I don't know if that's, maybe it's a combination of things, right? Like I have to assume it's growing up with the family that I had, the environment and the things like that. Yeah. But the fact that I maybe think it's better to be addicted to bettering yourself than doing, you know, coke off of someone's butt at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday before you have to go to work.
Yeah. I mean, if I had to have a choice, I would choose bettering yourself. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But you know,
you know what? I mean, it's rare that 1 + 1 = 2 when we're talking about the development of a person, right? So we have genetic predisposition, we have family influence, we have peer influence, we have educational drives, we have our own individual personalities. Take a family of 10 siblings. Each of them have 10 completely different experiences. They had 10 different parents because we have parents showing up at different points in their life for these kids, different points in their marriage, different points in what's happening in their own family of origin. So there's a lot that can goes into and contributes to who we are and how we approach the world and how we perceive the world as well.
Yeah. And speaking of that, we had a question wrote in about growing up with an addict. So a parent figure is struggling, you know, you see that your whole childhood. How does that inform our relationships with alcohol? Because I've personally seen it like two ways, you know, you're either
that's what I was going to say.
Diving in or like abstinent, like what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Generally it goes one of two ways, whether you're repeating that same type of relationship. There's a wonderful, I don't like to like book drop a lot, but there's
books here.
I know, but sometimes people are like, read this book, read that book, read this book. And I'm like, you know, they can't all be
give
good.
It to us.
There's a wonderful book. I think it's copyrighted 1981. It's a gem.
Love it.
The book is called It Will Never Happen to Me, and it's by Claudia Black. She's around. She's absolutely amazing. She does an incredible amount of research in terms of how alcohol and addiction impacts kids in the family system. So kind of one of two ways is that a lot. That's a great book if anyone's ever curious about their own family history or how they ended up in this place. Some of the analogies that she uses are a little outdated, I would say, because it's copyright 1981, but it's a good resource. What I tend to see is either we're repeating those patterns, right? So kids who grow up with alcoholic parents sometimes themselves will also become addicted or alcoholic, or get into a relationship with people that really struggle with their drug and alcohol abuse, or they are 100% anti, never happening, not me, won't even consider, you know, just very much on the opposite ends of that. There definitely are, I mean, there's exceptions to every rule. That's not a hard, fast rule. There's definitely gray areas in between. That's just kind of the two that seem to be most prevalent.
And I'm seeing an interest, and there was a question asked about this, and I'm also seeing it personally with like my friends, and even fueled by the pandemic, like you mentioned, where we're adults, we're in our early 30s, late 20s, and our parents are older, and we're seeing our old adult parents becoming, you know, either retired and now all they do is drink. And it's like, we're all grown-ups. Like, I can't, you know, maybe I didn't have any agency as a kid to be able to say, hey, that's not good. But I certainly don't have any as a 30-year-old to be like, hey, you should cut back. Like, we're all, it feels too far gone. So I'm curious about your thoughts as maybe like older people deal with their parents' drinking or addiction or use habits changing. Like, what the fuck is that about?
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, there's been a big culture shift over the last 20 years in terms of alcohol and what it looks like. It's not just like you drink scotch, right? Which I think is like, you're a businessman who drinks scotch. I think that was something from like the 70s, that there's been a huge uptick in wine. There's been a huge uptick in these craft beers, these IPAs, everyone's opening a brewery, everyone's got all this stuff. So I think the prevalence and also the social promotion specifically of alcohol has gone through the roof over the last 20 years, for sure. So that, I think, has influenced then when people are older and how they retire and how they spend their time, it changes, right? You have a bunch of retired 60-year-old women that are like, we're going wine tasting now, right? Like, that wasn't a thing. When I was a kid, like 60-year-old women, they were not wine tasting.
Right.
That's not, I don't know what they were doing, but it wasn't wine tasting.
It was like cards or something.
Yeah, like bridge.
Yes, yes.
Like, we're going to play bridge. I remember my grandma would always have like her bridge club.
Exactly.
Like, once they'd all come over and play bridge.
But don't you think that was just a cover for all of them, like either fucking each other or like doing coke or something? I feel like it was naughty.
I don't know. I have to say, for that group, probably none of the above. They were pretty,
I grew up in Florida.
Pretty kosher people.
Maybe a little different story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably a different story there. But I think at any point in time, regardless of how old your parents are or regardless how old you are, if you see someone that's doing something that doesn't feel safe, that you can certainly say to them, like, maybe I don't see the full picture. Maybe I, you know, kind of put your disclaimers out there. I know I'm not here all the time. I know we don't live together. And when we are together, it just seems a little concerning.
Right.
So whatever you want to do with that information, you can do with that information. I just want to make sure that I'm being clear with myself and that I'm being clear with you, and I'm doing everything I can to help keep you safe. When we tie things to safety, like, you kind of can't argue with that.
I agree. Personally, I agree. If someone said their safety felt threatened around me and my usage, but I feel like when it's family, they're just like, oh, you're being so dramatic, or, oh, don't be, you know, like, safety, you're a grown woman. Like, what's unsafe about this? Or, I'm not drinking and driving, or, you know.
Well, right.
Right.
And so they might say that, and we're not expressing our concern to try to control their response. We are expressing our concern because we know that that's what feels good for us. And that if we express our concern, we can sleep better at night.
That's
because
nice.
What, I mean, worst case scenario, we don't say anything, something happens, and now we're like, oh my God, why didn't I say something?
Yeah. There's certainly a, you know, growing up with family with addiction and drug use, there became a point early, maybe I was still in my teens, where I had to go, I did everything I could. And if they die tomorrow, I wouldn't feel bad about the things I did. You know, I tried as much to lead the horse to water. And if it doesn't drink water and it dies of dehydration, like, girl, that's on you. So I feel like there's definitely something to exactly what you're saying, like that peace within yourself of if you it's better to say something and maybe fear that. I think people don't want to mess up relationships, right? Like even with a partner or a lover or whatever, that you're fearful that it will distance the relationship or cause distance. And
yeah, but like, this is where you have to be honest with yourself, because your anxiety about not saying something is creating distance. Mm. It's exactly what's happening there. You're sitting there thinking, should I say something? Oh my God, are they going to go get another drink? What's happening? Okay, how are they getting home? Let's leave early enough so we're not staying to we're past the point of no return. Like there's already distance there.
Yeah.
Like, let's just be honest about it.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, we're not really tapping into those systems and considering our own feelings about it. And even like subconsciously what that does to the relationships, the way you might start to view that person, you know, like as infantilizing or whatever them. And, so I guess wrapping up, I want to know when people get, they've maybe are able to identify and label their situation as either someone they love or maybe either themselves has an unhealthy relationship, maybe addiction, substance abuse disorder. What are like our first steps even?
So it can be different for everybody. First of all, let's talk about first steps when you have someone that you love that you're concerned about. So first steps is to communicate with them clearly and directly, right? When you drink, this is what happens. What would you like to do about it? Right? So clearly and directly, this is a concern, and let me present to you a question which helps you feel like you have choice in this, which can increase the probability that you're going to do something about it, right? So when we see someone that's concerning, and then again, like tying it back to safety, and if the safety continues to get ramped up, like the concern for that, then you have to make a lot of times very difficult decisions rooted in safety. Well, I'm sorry, but you can't pick me up from work anymore because I don't feel safe driving in the car with you. Or I'm sorry, I can't have you babysit the kids, or I can't let you dog watch, you know, little Brewster or whatever, because I'm concerned that something's going to happen because it doesn't feel safe. Those are not easy steps to take. It's not comfortable. There's no good choice there. I'm asking you, do you want to eat a chocolate cockroach or do you want to eat a chocolate centipede? Like, they both suck.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is what happens when drug and alcohol addiction is a part of your world. So if you have a concern for somebody else, express it to them clearly and directly. Ask them what they want to do about it so they feel like they have a choice and they feel like there's some options there for them. And if safety continues to be an issue, you're going to have to make some really hard choices and be really honest with yourself about that. Now, if you yourself are like, oh God, this feels like it's getting a little out of control, tell somebody. And chances are the majority of people in your life are already concerned and they already know. You don't have to have a plan. You don't have to make any commitments. You just need to say, hey, listen, I need help. No one has to define for you. Oh, well, it's only, you only drink two nights a week. Okay, but I'm blocking out two nights a week. It's a problem, right? Or I just lose my patience a little bit when I'm drinking. Or I'm drinking all day long because I feel like I'm going to get sick. Whatever range of alcohol uses in your life, if it doesn't feel okay for you, find someone that you trust who you know has shown up for you consistently and come through for you, that you can say, listen, this just doesn't feel good and I want to change it about myself and I don't know what to do. Can we talk about it? That's all you have to do. That's it.
I think what kept me drinking for as long as I did, and this is probably my biggest regret, is that I didn't stop sooner, because I wonder, like, I was very successful as a drunk. I was arguably making the most money, doing the most job. Like, that was my prime, if you will say. But internally, I was a gaping, infected wound, like, obviously. But I think that's what kept me doing it for as long as I did, was that I was such a good drunk. And people will tell you, like, I didn't even know you were blacked out at that thing. Like, you had it together. Yep. Like, you weren't falling over. You never embarrassed yourself. I never had a hard rock bottom, you know? I had a lot of soft bottoms. And it got to the point where I made my co-host on our e-show, Dating No Filter, go watch it on Hulu. He was sober, and he's like, I don't give a shit if you get sober, but, like, damn, you have a problem. Like, you're showing up like that. Yeah. Do you want to talk about it? Like, he was the first person where I was like, oh, this person gets it and, like, doesn't care.
No.
And that's, like, alarming to me. Why doesn't he care? Why, like, shouldn't he, like, And that was the first time in my life where it was when I talked to someone who had been on it at the same level as me and was like, I see through your bullshit and I see through your, and, you know, he was, like, becoming my best friend too at the time. There was a lot of trust. There was a lot of, and, you know, we're still best friends to this day. I wanted to ask about boundaries with relapse, because as you were talking about the loved ones, I remember all the times that I said I was going to quit and would go, like, 30 or 60 days and be like, okay, I did it. I did quit. I did and was successful. And now I'm going to start drinking again. And, like, where do we set boundaries maybe with the people we love and ourselves of, like, relapse being an excuse or an issue?
No one else is responsible for your recovery. And at the same time, people have to do what feels best for them. Right. So people may have their feelings hurt. They may be upset. They may not have had the same vision for your process. And so therefore, they may pull back when you begin to use drugs and alcohol again. Mm-hmm. And that's just part of the process. That's them keeping themselves safe, or their environment safe, their own mental health safe, whatever the case may be. But no one else is responsible for that. Mm. So if you're looking to someone to say, I need support, that's fine. Make sure you're not covertly asking them, I need you to do this recovery thing for me, because nobody else is responsible for that, right? Mm. So a lot of times when it comes to families, when it comes to romantic relationships, there's these blurred boundaries of, like, well, don't you have a meeting today? Or aren't, you know, today's day 542. Or, you know, oh, do you think you should be going out to dinner with that person? I remember they were a little crazy back in the day. No one else can be responsible for your recovery. None.
Damn, that was some truth spoken right there too. Because it all ties back to your will to, and again, I don't know how to say this without being like, your want to keeping this disease or infliction or problem at bay, right? Like there's, now to me, it's so easy, but in the beginning, it was like the first 2 weeks were the fucking hardest. What just kept me going was this, it just felt different than every other time where I was like, this has to be it. And so any like final wrap up advice for people maybe, that are thinking about this subject now that we've had such a gorgeous conversation about it?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have any like amazing words of wisdom that you're going to like make with your frickin' stick it on a t-shirt, but something that I was thinking of when you were just talking about will is I was reframing that in my mind as honesty with yourself.
Ooh, say it.
Because will is like your like energy, I feel, your motivation. And some mornings, I mean, I don't feel like doing anything.
Amen.
Like today, it's where I am. It's raining. It's miserable. It stinks. I didn't even feel like coming into my office because I actually had to put on real shoes. It was terrible.
You look gorgeous. But you did it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I did it. But my will and my energy on a day when it's beautiful out, I'm like here early, you know, life's great. So I think it's just, it's more so how honest can you be with yourself? and how honest are you willing to be with yourself? And that's not always a beautiful process, but like, it's absolutely worth it. Mm. No matter what you're going through, whether it's drug and alcohol addiction or an unhealthy relationship or changing careers or making choices that kind of go against family legacies, like being honest with yourself is like the keystone of all of that.
Man, now you just have my brain going down another hole of like, we need to do a whole episode on just getting out of unhealthy relationships, because that could have really helped me 10 years ago. Well, Brynn, you are just such a delight and such a well-informed and incredible guest. And thank you for the work that you do, because we definitely need more of it. And I hope that this helps some people out there listening. And so where can the Confidant find you and your work and find more all about what you do?
We have a lot of places. Go to UCATherapy.com. We are on Instagram, UCATherapy. We post all kinds of stuff all day long. Right now we're doing things on the road. We kind of pick like different topics. There's a Facebook page. I think the Facebook page is really but those are kind of the three.
Of course, make sure to help all that I can get. So cool. I was binging it this morning. It's so helpful. It's just good stuff that keeps on your time, you know?